I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Crazy in Love is the true crime podcast that tells love stories with a twist.
This crime was really shocking, and it was so shocking that initially people who witnessed it thought maybe like a movie was being filmed or something.
Sometimes the twist of a knife.
It's like this very specific story that either it's so crazy that it has to be true, or it's so crazy that it's unbelievable.
Just because things start off with once upon a time doesn't mean everyone lives happily ever after. This is Crazy in Love, a production of KT Studios and iHeartRadio. I'm Courtney Armstrong, a crime producer at KT Studios, joined by fellow producers Stephanie Leidecker, Jeff Shane, and Beth Greenwald. We've all worked for years on various crime podcasts and TV series. As crime producers, we talk murder all the time. One thing we've noticed is just how many of them stem from love. In this episode, we're exploring the case of the daycare, the affair, and the cover-up. While attending Indiana University, Rusty Snyderman met Andrea Greenberg at the local Jewish Hillel. The pair immediately hit it off. According to Rusty's college roommate and best friend, Andrea was the typical nice Jewish girl from the suburbs. She was smart, ambitious, had goals, and it was clear to everyone that they were destined to be together. After graduating college, the couple moved into a small Chicago apartment. Despite her parents protesting against living together before marriage, Andrea was adamant. They belonged together, and it didn't matter since they were going to get married sooner or later. Rusty was doing well financially and started to set money aside for what he called the ring fund. Andrea was over the moon. She picked out a design for an engagement ring, and Rusty ordered it. The only surprise for her was when it would happen. Rusty ended up proposing in 2000 while they vacationed in Orange County, California. On December 30th, 2000, the pair tied the knot in a ceremony in the same Florida synagogue Andrea's grandparents co-founded. Friends and family described them as a solid team. Rusty's sister said Andrea was a good match for Rusty since she was warm and sincere. Everyone had a great feeling about the couple and thought they would grow old together. Here's Jeff.
A lot of the stories we talk about are kind of whirlwind romances where they get married rather quickly or get together rather quickly. You know, they were together for 7 years before he even proposed. So they definitely took the time to get to know each other and laid the groundwork for what we could see as and what other people who knew them would see as an everlasting relationship.
Here's Beth.
Yeah, you know, spending that time, you really get to know someone to the core, and they had a strong foundation. started a family and was able to take the time to really invest in what he wanted to do with his entrepreneurial spirit and with what Andrea wanted to do with her life.
Here's Stephanie.
Beth, Jeff, and I were just discussing the fact that this case was particularly troublesome because, again, from the outside, it all looked rather perfect. There didn't seem to be some sort of crack in their relationship.
After Rusty earned an MBA at Harvard, the newlyweds moved to the idyllic Atlanta suburb of Dunwoody to start a family. The gated community welcome sign reads, "Smart city, smart people." The quiet suburb is dotted with large brick homes, tennis courts, churches, and private schools. The pair had two children, and Rusty was a great father. He would play for hours with his children while Andrea tended to the house. At 36 years old, Rusty had a lot to be proud of. He had a successful business, a loving wife, and a beautiful home. When the kids were 2 and 5 years old, Andrea took a job at General Electric in the engineering department. Rusty supported this wholeheartedly. Here's Stephanie.
Yeah, and he kind of was ahead of his time. Rusty started his business and really was onto something that we now know is a big piece of social media.
Yeah, I was super surprised because he was so successful in finance and to kind of walk away from that to become an entrepreneur, Steph. I mean, to go into business for yourself is not easy, but his startup was a great idea. I mean, it was this company where a celebrity can do an outgoing voicemail message for your cell phone and, you know, pay a small fee. And it was really catching on. And to be honest with you, it's kind of like Cameo before there was Cameo, which is, as we all know now, a huge company.
A huge company, and that afforded them the ability to go move to the suburbs, buy a beautiful home. They lived in this perfect suburb. And as neighbors have said, they seemed like a couple who had everything going for them.
Yeah, it's kind of like the movie The Truman Show, if you've ever seen it, this very perfect, idyllic, gated community in the suburb of Dunwoody. The welcome sign literally reads, "Smart city, smart people." It's dotted with large brick homes, tennis courts, churches, private schools. And the Snedermans kind of lived in the creme de la creme of the neighborhood in a $1 million home on a quiet cul-de-sac. And once they got there, Andrea and Rusty really integrated themselves. They volunteered at the Jewish organizations and other charitable events. And people took notice.
Seems like a family you'd want to live next door to.
While the family moved to the suburbs for security and safety, that was all taken away from them one tragic morning. On November 18th, 2010, Rusty drove his 2-year-old son to daycare and dropped him off at 9:15 a.m. As Rusty walked back to his car, a man came up to him and shot him several times. With shocked parents, teachers, and children watching, the shooter then ran back to a light-colored minivan and disappeared. Rusty Snyderman died en route to the hospital.
Dunwoody was an idyllic, safe suburb. So this crime was really shocking. And it was so shocking that initially people who witnessed it thought maybe like a movie was being filmed or something because it was so unbelievable. But witnesses did recall some of the details of what they saw because it was just such a memorable thing. They said that the shooter had on glasses and what most witnesses described as a fake beard. He was so big and bushy, but no one recognized the shooter.
And there was a couple of other really distinct, odd things that happened. You know, initially the teacher at the preschool called Andrea and told her there had been a hideous accident and that Rusty was on his way to the hospital. And she, of course, went there. And the parents of the school and the doctors and the nurses, they all sort of had the same note about Andrea, because when she came to the hospital, knowing that Rusty was potentially fighting for his life, we now know at this point he already had passed, she wasn't even crying. She had literally zero reaction, which some thought maybe she was in shock. And also worth noting, she had a psychiatrist talk to her children and tell them about their father's death. She did not want to look them in the eye and do that herself.
So obviously Rusty's death was a horrible tragedy, but as officials were kind of figuring out what happened, they started to look at things that happened to the family prior to the death, which would kind of end up being this ominous foreshadowing of what would occur at the school. There were a couple of weird instances that now couldn't be ignored. First, 3 weeks before the murder, the garage door opened in the middle of the night without any explanation at the Snyderman house. When Rusty went to check it out, nothing had been stolen and it didn't appear anyone even entered the home. But it was weird and police filed the report, but nothing came of it. Then 2 weeks later, just 1 week before the murder, Rusty was getting ready to take his son to daycare as he did every day. And he thought he smelled gas. So he walked around to the side of the house to check the meter and he saw a man lying face down on the ground near the air conditioning unit. And, you know, startled, he called out to the guy to see if he was okay. And the man who was lying down immediately stood up and took off running. And Rusty, you know, ran inside and called 911 and told them what happened and that he also spotted what he thought was a gun in the man's back pocket. Unfortunately, he couldn't identify this guy, but it was obviously very unsettling to the family. But again, nothing happened. Police never were able to make an arrest. A week later, he's found dead in the parking lot. These two things just couldn't be ignored.
Looking at this objectively, I'm sure officials could not imagine that anybody who was close to Rusty would ever put their children in the line of fire. You know, he was shot basically bringing his child to school at a daycare that he knew everybody. So it just seemed unusual that anybody who was close to him specifically would want to bring harm to his children as well or the other children at the school.
I think this was also hard for people to wrap their head around because Dunwoody was such a safe community. So, you know, first it's the garage door, then it's someone maybe futzing with the gas, and then it's literally shooting someone dead in the parking lot of a school. This doesn't happen in a place like Dunwoody. And so I think people were just so shocked and had no idea what could possibly be happening.
And Rusty had done all the right things. He alerted police. He, you know, was on record. There was a report on all of these incidences. Probably in retrospect, maybe there was more to be done, but you know, to some degree, it seemed as though he was being hunted.
I mean, I wonder if it was just because it's hard to believe in this town where it's not a crime-ridden neighborhood that suddenly you have these instances that maybe they brushed it off. But it obviously was something very serious that ultimately led to Rusty's demise.
Following the murder, police started their investigation. Initially, Andrea told investigators that Rusty's business dealings could be at the heart of the crime. But a look into his finances and talks with his business partners didn't set off any alarms. Police asked Andrea if there was anyone in her life who would try to separate them as a couple. She hesitantly answered yes and no. When pressed for details, Andrea said that her boss at GE, a man named Hemi Newman, was very flirty with her, almost to the point of infatuation. Andrea and Hemi's coworkers seemed to agree that there was something going on. Hemi seemed to dote on Andrea. She'd only been at GE for 8 months, but she was promoted ahead of people who had worked there for years. Meanwhile, police continued to hunt down the driver of the minivan. Investigators realized they caught a lucky break when looking at footage from nearby security cameras. It turns out the daycare had their own camera that faced the parking lot. While they were unfortunately unable to make out the license plate, the camera did indeed catch the killer speeding out of the lot. Unable to decipher the make and model themselves, police sent screenshots of the video to various engineers who worked at car companies. One of those engineers was able to identify the silver vehicle as a Kia Sedona minivan. Police tracked down the 11 people in the state of Georgia who owned one. 10 had alibis, and the 11th was a car rental company. The car company handed over their logs to authorities and quickly police zeroed in on the familiar name. Henny Newman, Andrea's flirty boss at GE, had rented the Kia Sedona minivan the day of the murder. During Hemi's initial interrogation, he remained eerily calm. Here's a portion of the interrogation.
I'm giving you every opportunity. You've got a heart, you've got a soul. You were there when Rusty got shot. Now, Hemi, you were there. You got it, man, huh?
The jig is up. No. You're our guy.
I don't see how you can play skin. I don't know what to tell you. I'm not there. I don't own a gun. I can't explain the band.
You're going to tell us, on stack bottles, I did not shoot Rusty.
I was not there. I did not pull the trigger on the gun.
So there's a lot to unpack here. Also really speaks to the importance of having security cameras around our house. It's amazing how much diligent investigative work happens as a result. So yeah, we know that Henny came back from a family vacation in Florida. Police brought him in for interrogation, and he denies everything. But bottom line, this van really seemed like too much of a coincidence to not be tied to Hemi. And they really did believe they had their guy.
Yeah, and as they continued to investigate him, because how could they not, his motive became clear. So they start to look at Hemi's connection to the family. Obviously, it's Andrea. And what they find is that this office flirtation crush, as she described it, might have actually been a little more reciprocated than she described originally. Prior to the murder, Andrea and Hemi were very close working colleagues. They would travel the world together for business, from Lake Tahoe to Scotland. They kind of saw it all. And according to one of Hemi's closest friends, Hemi was, quote unquote, obsessed with Andrea. When police were talking to potential witnesses at the places they would travel together, they spoke to one bartender in South Carolina at a resort where they had stayed. And she told them that she remembered Andrea and Hemi coming into the bar and that they were all over each other, flirting and kissing and dancing. She thought they looked like a newlywed couple.
Yeah, Jeff. And so now they had Hemi in the van. They're hearing all this information about, you know, Hemi and Andrea traveling together for business. So when the police pulled their cell phone records, there were over 1,400 calls and texts between Hemi and Andrea. And some of these texts were really incriminating. They were, you know, saying things like, I want to raise your kids. I want to marry you. And Andrea was still denying, despite this mountain of evidence that was starting to develop. There were also emails between them about trips that they planned to go on and how scandalous it would be if anyone found out that they were together on these business trips. And one email in particular, Andrea says that she had betrayed everyone she knows and has to repent. And when the authorities asked her about that, Andrea said that all she and Hemi had ever done was hold hands, which seems highly unlikely given I want to marry you, I want to raise your kids.
Yeah, I mean, remember though, like Andrea is a very good Jewish girl as she's been described. And so maybe she did just feel guilty about holding his hand. That could be something that someone who's traditional and religious would feel guilty about, would have to repent over, as she says.
But we do know that there are accounts of that not being a case, as suggested by the woman at the bar who saw them looking like newlyweds.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, the story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Andrea tried to say that Hemi was kind of had an obsessive fondness for her, but it doesn't seem like Andrea was putting up boundaries. It seemed like Andrea was also flirting back with him, and it seemed like there was some sort of inappropriate relationship there.
Yeah, Hemi was married, had kids of his own, and you know, when the police talked to his wife, she told them that she knew Hemi was having an affair with Andrea. In her gut, she knew it the whole time. It kind of seems like this GE affair they were having was the company's worst kept secret. Everyone knew it. They were very public about it. Whether or not Rusty knew, we'll never know.
And to that end, you know, by all accounts, Andrea was a pretty reserved woman. This was, you know, seemingly very out of character for her. So it was hard for people to believe.
Hemi turned out maybe to be a little bit like the boss from hell. He was described as those who worked for him as absorbed, abrasive, and arrogant, always making sure that he was presenting himself as the smartest man in the room.
And for Andrea, who, you know, she's been with Rusty her entire life, essentially, since college. She hadn't dated anybody else before, so she might not have had any tools to know how to even handle a situation when her boss, a very powerful person, is potentially coming on to her, or in her mind, is kind of obsessing about her.
Keep in mind, you know, she was a stay-at-home mom for a while and was working from home for a period of time when the kids were young and just gotten back to work and just gotten, I think, was new to this job. So I think she was super attentive when her boss reached out, whether it be by text or by email.
1,400 texts and calls and emails is a lot of communication. And there's definitely a line professionally that, you know, you don't cross. And so joking about waking up in the same hotel room is certainly inappropriate.
Her defense was the otherwise. I didn't know what to do. These advances, I should have reported it. I should have quit my job. She seemed to welcome these advances in some way. If they're talking about the excitement of going on trips together. Steph, do you have anything to say about that?
I just am kind of curious about the fact that, you know, Hemi is with his family and is interrogated by police, you know, continues to deny things. But how can you deny it when your vehicle that you've actually rented is seen at the crime scene? We see this a lot as well. In circumstances like this, where love or infatuation or obsession is at the root of things, typically they turn on each other, right, at some point. But, you know, Hemi's keeping his cards very close, and it seems as though Andrea is pretty quick to point the finger at him and distance herself as quickly as possible. And that might also speak to her demeanor when she got to the hospital, which was noted earlier that she seemingly had no emotion whatsoever and didn't want to personally talk to her children about their father's death. Is that guilt setting in such an extraordinary way that she cannot face her two children? Whether that's because she's been having an affair outside the marriage or that there's something more to it.
My initial reaction was, once you say those things to your kids or say the things to anyone, do they look at you differently for the rest of their life? Because that news coming out of your mouth is gut-wrenching and will change their lives forever. So when she originally asked for someone else to tell them, that's where I went with it.
I could see that from all sides. I would imagine it would be customary for the mother to be there unless she was so distraught that she was unable to participate in some way. But again, she seemed, according to everybody there, very non-emotional.
Right. When you combine the lack of reaction to police, the lack of tears, lack of crying with not wanting to tell your kids, then that starts to paint a picture of someone who's a little cold and a little emotionally removed from this very traumatic event.
And not to mention trauma in general, we also can't assume how a person is going to behave in such a traumatic situation. Trauma affects everyone very, very differently, and she may have been in shock.
At the trial, Hemi pled guilty by reason of insanity. His attorneys claimed he was driven by demons and angels who possessed him to kill Rusty Snyderman. The demon, he said, sounded like Barry White, and the angel was Olivia Newton-John. Hemi said he murdered Rusty because Olivia Newton-John convinced him that Rusty's children were actually his own children and that they were in mortal danger if he didn't do something about it. However, as the trial progressed, the attention really turned to Andrea. During her testimony, Andrea would get combative with prosecutors, acting annoyed by their line of questioning. But the biggest shock of all came when Rusty's parents revealed exactly when Andrea told them about the shooting. It was allegedly before officials had told Andrea that her husband had been shot. This called her entire timeline into question. Here's audio of Andrea on the stand, followed by Rusty's father, also in court.
How many times did you call Rusty?
Call Rusty?
Rusty.
0 times.
Why didn't you call Rusty?
Because they just told me something had happened to Rusty. What are the chances that he's going to be answering his cell phone?
They didn't tell you what happened to Rusty.
Sir, do you have a question? They took me into what I call the death room.
Okay, so they told
you. I sat in a chair, and someone I have no idea who they are came over and said that he came in with multiple gunshot wounds and that he was dead. I don't remember anything they said after that.
Okay, so you found...
I fell to the floor.
You found out at the hospital that Rusty had been shot.
That's correct.
Okay.
Andrea called us, and she called and said Rusty had been shot. She was so, so sorry, and that she was going to Dunwoody Prep to find out what had happened.
And are you sure that she told you that Rusty had been shot?
Yes, sir.
I think what we should talk about is the inconsistency in Andrea's timeline, because it kind of comes into play with Hemi being involved and potentially Andrea, Rusty's wife, being involved. So remember, Andrea got a call from the school that there was an emergency after Rusty had been shot. So she drove to the daycare and they told her to go to the hospital. At this point, no one had told her about the shooting or that there was a gun or anything that Rusty had been shot. It wasn't until she got to the hospital that the police told her that Rusty had been shot. But on the way to the hospital, she called Rusty's parents and they testified to this, that on the way to the hospital, she called them and said, Rusty's been shot. She literally couldn't have known this information unless, of course, she knew that it was going to happen or had already happened from another source, maybe the shooter, Hemi.
He could have had a heart attack, for example, and been rushed to the hospital. She had no knowledge that it was actually a gunshot.
Right. She's breaking this shooting story before she's told this by officials. And not only did Rusty's parents say this on the stand, but her best friend said it. So it was definitely backed up that she was, you know, telling people about this shooting before anyone had actually told her about the shooting. And remember, her and Hemi were in constant communication. You know, when they looked at the police records, there were all those texts and emails. But even as soon as the day before the murder, they were talking. When they checked Hemi's credit card receipts, when he bought the, you know, disguise that we heard about, he was talking to Andrea literally as they were swiping his credit card.
I mean, honestly, that's pretty startling to hear. You know, this whole strategy, legally speaking, for Hemi to have mental illness, be hearing voices in his head, really baffled everybody. He had no history of mental illness. And in our experience, I haven't really heard of mental illness popping up mid-trial, especially when you're conveniently on a capital murder trial, no less. Because he ran this very large company, is it even possible that he was able to do so if he was having angels and demons and Olivia Newton-John in his head? Isn't that something that maybe would have been noted earlier? than just this moment suddenly in court. But keep in mind, you know, this whole mental illness thing popping up isn't necessarily the worst idea from the defense's point of view. It happens all the time. But you really do have to show some sort of a history. And again, if you're defending a potential killer, you really want to just make sure that you're casting as much doubt as possible so that one juror, just one, has a little bit of doubt. And that's all it takes to, you know, lose a conviction.
Yeah. And the story seems so specific that it's almost like, how could they make that up? Like Barry White and Olivia Newton-John are very, it's just so weird that like, that's to me, like it does, it's like not just insanity. It's like this very specific story.
Yeah, Jeff, these inconsistencies really shifted the attention towards Andrea. Because it was undeniable that this connection was more than she had let on. And again, the inconsistencies, the cracks began to show in what she had to say. And even Hemi's defense attorney, when he spoke to the jury and he spoke in court, he basically was saying that Andrea was playing everyone for a fool, that she was, you know, manipulative. And I think the defense attorney actually had put it best. And he said, quote, Hemi held the gun, but Andrea was the trigger.
And really, like, her attitude on the stand, too, is pretty telling to me. I mean, remember, she's not on trial at this point. Who's on trial is the murderer of her husband. She should be trying to put this man away. And instead, when the prosecutor and the defense attorneys are examining, are, you know, putting her on the stand, she sounds defensive. She sounds annoyed. She's rolling her eyes at some points. She should be doing everything she can to help find this guy guilty, you would think. But instead, she's doing basically the opposite.
Yeah, it was shocking. She seemed like a hostile witness. And again, this is the DA, who's the prosecutor, who's trying to put away the man who murdered her husband. You know, you'd think she'd want to help and not be so combative and just kind of angry and aggressive.
Not to mention, it's also the father of her children. So even on behalf of her children, you'd think she would want to make sure that the person who did this to him would be behind bars.
Let's stop here for another quick break.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpert.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, A Story of California Corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Originally, Hemi pled not guilty, but then during the trial, he changed his plea to not guilty due to reason of insanity, which is a very different plea.
You weren't of sound mind to be able to even justify what you were or were not doing, and maybe not capable of being trusted even as a witness or even to defend himself. That's a very convenient narrative to have pop up midstream. And again, you know, as we mentioned, there was no mental illness history in his past. You know, they looked into all of his records, and this is not something that came up ever before.
He's admitting that he did it at this point, but that he was insane when he did it. So as before, when he pled not guilty, now, you know, didn't he plead guilty, but the reason being insanity? So now at least he's admitted that he's done it.
True, which again, doesn't mean he's not going to go to prison. And again, this is a strategy that we see often in court. However, an insanity defense is very hard to prove. Generally speaking, we see that it's something that you probably never want to have to use, and it's very extreme. And in those extreme cases, you would really have to show a unique amount of history of mental illness to have that even be considered in the court of law.
It goes to the same thing about Andrea telling Rusty's parents. Andrea had told her best friend, Shayna Citron, that Rusty had been shot before she'd gotten to the hospital. So again, Andrea wasn't told anything. She just knew that Rusty was in an accident. And in addition to telling Rusty's parents that he had been shot, she's now told her best friend that he's been shot, but she still hasn't been told this yet.
While on the stand, Shayna also told the prosecutor how Andrea would confide to her that she and Rusty were having problems. Furthermore, they had this like kind of weird, icy exchange after the best friend testifies. The best friend gets off the stand and is walking out of the courtroom, and Andrea gets up and hugs her, which first off is highly inappropriate, and you're not supposed to do that. And she's later ejected from the courtroom. But they have this kind of sweet moment where she hugs her, and despite her best friend basically ripping her a new one on the stand and telling the jury she's a liar and all these things, they have this nice exchange. She's kicked out of the courtroom, and the best friend and her have another exchange, which looks very different. Andrea hugs her again, but it's not as nice is what the witnesses say. But Andrea says, I understand you did what you have to do, but I'm going to do what I have to do. And people who heard this, because it was in a crowded, you know, lobby of a courtroom, said it sounded like a very thinly veiled threat. The best friend was so shaken that the next day she pulled her kids from the school and kind of went into hiding almost.
Right, because she was worried for her own safety and the safety of her children for good reason.
And all she did was really tell the truth that Andrea had said, Rusty and I are having problems.
Right, which is a really difficult position to be in. Imagine you're being brought to the stand to basically testify against your very best friend in all of the world, who you probably could never imagine could do this. That is a difficult spot to be in. And yeah, I can completely understand why she would be fearful of retaliation.
In 2012, Hemi Newman was found guilty of murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. After the trial in August 2012, Andrew was arrested and indicted on 8 counts, including attempt to commit murder, insurance fraud, and perjury. In August 2013, Andrew was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison, A parole board reduced her sentence to just 22 months, and she walked free in June 2014. Since then, she's kept a low profile. While we don't know much about Andrea's time in jail or life after, we do know she's spoken about wanting Sandra Bullock to play her in the movie. If you're enjoying Crazy in Love, listen to seasons 1 and 2 of The Piketon Massacre, another KT Studios production. Crazy in Love is produced by Stephanie Leidecker, Beth Greenwald, Chris Graves, Lisa DiGiovine, Jeff Shane, Tim Hamilton, and me, Courtney Armstrong. Editing and sound design by Jeff Twa. Additional editing by Davey Cooper Wasser. Crazy in Love is a production of iHeartRadio and KT Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.